You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 14th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writer and filmmaker Rupert Russell, author and director of Price Wars, How the Commodities Markets Made Our Chaotic World. Also on the program today, Ukraine claims Russia has started a hybrid war, but not convinced the ground invasion is imminent. Meanwhile, U.S. evacuates embassy staff. In the Senate, Benray Lujan expects to be back in the Senate for the Supreme Court confirmation. Fingers crossed. The Canadian bridge blockade ends as the protesters let their Q flag fly. The FDA delays vax approval for children under five. New CDC data shows that boosters last only about 4 months. So expect number four coming to a pharmacy near you. Texas's ban on mail-in ballots was blocked by a federal judge. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court blocks an emergency request to block the New York City vaccine mandate. Approximately 3,000 New York City employees terminated shortly because of their refusal to get vaccinated. In Seattle, 300 concrete workers of the local Teamster union on strike. Meanwhile, in Puerto Rico, 80% of teachers and thousands of public workers are on strike for higher wages in Puerto Rico. Tesla facing a massive discrimination suit. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Happy Monday. Happy Valentine's Day. For those of you who got suckered into this fake holiday. Emma, happy day after the Super Bowl.
Oh, well, you sound a little salty about Valentine's Day.
Well, you know, I have mixed feelings because the first Valentine's Day card was actually invented in Worcester, Massachusetts.
I'm pulling at you. My hair, there's something going on.
The romance capital of the world.
The romance capital of the world. Also, coincidentally, the pill also developed in Worcester, Massachusetts.
That works hand in hand.
Maybe that's not a coincidence. I'm perfectly okay with Valentine's Day. I've just, for reasons that need not be mentioned here, I have associations with Valentine's Day that are fairly unique. That made it a little difficult for me in my older years.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's that. Let's leave it at that. But for others, go at it.
Yeah.
I get, you know, have fun.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Have fun being suckered.
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't have to do anything. I just receive.
All right. Well, good for you. I'm glad to hear that.
But the Super Bowl was last night, so there's that.
Yeah. Do you want to say a couple of words? I mean, a lot of people are tuning in this morning for
Well, I mean, I probably should have just stuck to White Claw or wine, not both. So a little tired today. Yeah.
The one thing that struck me about that was my introduction to the new hard seltzer that it seems like every beer company puts out, and their inability, like, I don't know how they sit around thinking like, let's call this four names.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Michelob organic.
They're different brands. They're not all the same seltzer.
No, I understand. But they all have, like, you know, like there's five different names to it's ridiculous. Just come up with a different company and put it out. Like, okay. Why do you have to put it under Michelob? It's a beer. Budweiser's a beer. It's just weird. I don't care about any of that, frankly.
Well, I'll say this. The better team won last night, even though the Bengals were a beautiful Cinderella story. But the better team won. I'm heartbroken that Odell hurt his knee again, but he got a ring. All these amazing players that deserve recognition got a ring.
Matt Stafford.
Matt Stafford, defense brigade here, always deserve more in Detroit. Aaron Donald, one of the greats, arguably top five greatest, arguably top three greatest defensive player of all time, got a ring. Jalen Ramsey had a rough night, still got a ring. Great players, they deserve it. And I appreciate the all-in approach that they did. This is the Rams are NBA-ing it in the NFL. And I kind of like that change.
People are going to have to tune in later in the program to understand what that means, because I don't understand what that means. But I just think that, like, I also don't know that, like, the idea of, you know, guys who've been playing for a long time deserve. That's what the ESPY is for.
Right, right.
The ESPY, they don't need to get the.
ESPY.
It's nice to get recognized.
Yeah, right, totally.
All right, let's jump into this. I've already lost my sound sheet. Somehow. Oh, here it is. This video was put out by The Intercept, but we felt like it deserved some amplification. Or, I don't know, I guess it depends on your perspective. Maybe de-amplification. I don't think that we're going to actually inhibit it going out there in any way. The House, as you may know, passed this competes bill, which deals with a whole host of infrastructure and some industrial planning and to deal with economic competition with China. One of the amendments that was offered was by Pramila Jayapal, and it was an investigation into the Biden administration's decision to confiscate Afghan money that they had frozen, $7 billion worth of Afghan money, the Afghan government's money, and splitting it up, one, to make it available to 9/11 survivors or families who are looking involved in a civil suit. This is on top of the compensation fund. And two, ostensibly to provide direct humanitarian aid to Afghanistan, as opposed to us providing aid. It's returning their money, is what it is. And so here's Jayapal's amendment to investigate just that act. And here is the video by The Intercept. I should say that the text here mentions the introduction of the amendment to study. It's going to study the consequences of using this money so that people can be really clear as to the implications for what looks like potential mass starvation in Afghanistan.
Yes, 2/3 of the Afghan population is in poverty right now, and there are 4.7 million face malnutrition, according to the New York Times. This is dire.
Starvation could kill 1 million children this winter. American policymakers deserve to have a complete and comprehensive picture of what is occurring in Afghanistan.
Members will record their vote by electronic device.
Every
Congressman, do you have a minute to talk about Afghanistan?
Voted no. And here's The Intercept going on. Continue to play it.
Are you concerned at all about sanctions and humanitarian suffering there? Congressman, do you have a minute to talk about Afghanistan?
Real quick, yeah.
I believe you voted against that amendment. I mean, do you think that we should be studying the humanitarian suffering there?
I mean, I think we should study the humanitarian suffering everywhere. Obviously, humanitarian suffering all over this planet, right? I'm not in favor of giving money that I'm pretty confident will end up in the hands of the Taliban.
Congresswoman, can I ask you a question about Afghanistan? Not about Afghanistan?
What, about the shameful withdrawal?
Well, that's a pretty big deal, too.
Killed, about the drone strike that killed
many. Actually, about the millions of children that were starving.
Why don't you go talk to Biden?
I think that matters, too, and it's the Biden administration that's doing this.
We're talking about the precipice of a massive famine, or, you know, one that's going on, and we have a responsibility to make sure that that our foreign policy doesn't contribute to that.
You have no time to talk about the starving children in Afghanistan. When will you have time?
My office is an arranged time.
You don't, I mean, it's just a quick explanation. Why did you vote against reviewing sanctions and freezing of assets that's starving millions of people? Aren't the lives of millions of children worth more than that? Do you have any thoughts about the sanctions and the freezing of assets in Afghanistan that are starving millions of Afghans? You don't have any concern? Does it weigh on your conscience at all that thousands of children are starving right now while we sit on our hands? Congresswoman, can I ask why you voted against an amendment to review the sanctions on Afghanistan last week? Just a brief explanation of the vote. Nothing? It's not worth your time at all?
Wait, how did Val Demings vote? I missed.
Val Demings, one of the 44 Democrats who voted against the amendment.
Okay.
A list is available. You can find that at... you can find it just by Googling roll call on bill number HR 4521, and
telling that Ocasio-Cortez was pretty much the only lawmaker to stop to speak to The Intercept there.
Yes, and I imagine they had others who had voted in favor, Democratic ones who had voted in favor, it's a good, you get a good sense of where these people are. In terms of, New York, Sean Maloney, for instance, voted against. Delgado even voted against. It's pretty shocking to me how you could vote even against the actual, just a report on this. And it's, part of it is because nobody wants to talk about how we have left Afghanistan. And...
I mean, we've stolen their money as they're in famine.
Here's the thing. I can understand how people are saying they don't want the Taliban to have money because the Taliban is bad. But but why do we care that the Taliban is bad? I'm trying to make this like simple so that a seventh grader could understand this. We think the Taliban is bad because they do bad things to the Afghan people. Right? I mean, that's why we say they're bad, why we wouldn't want to give them money.
Well, I think a lot of seventh grade-minded Americans might say, well, they might attack us. That's the main concern. They're afraid of another 9/11.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the Taliban did not attack us. The Taliban shielded people who did. That's true. But that was not a function of their money. The money... to support those attacks came from Saudi Arabia. So I understand you're in seventh grade, and so you think the Taliban attacked us. They did not. So the bottom line is, we cannot like the Taliban, but if some of that money gets to the Afghan people, which is in the best interest of the Taliban, like, it's not in the best interest of the Taliban to have a non-functioning economy.
Yeah.
It is not in the best interest of the Taliban to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of children die. That's not going to help the Taliban. They're going to get some of that money there. If we don't want to give money to the Taliban because they're bad, and they're bad because they treat the Afghan people poorly, understand we're doing worse still.
And it's interesting that you bring up Saudi Arabia, too, because despite the money for 9/11 coming from Saudi coffers, we give them arms, billions and billions of dollars of aid and help in order to further their own military conflicts.
We sell them arms. We get some money back. But yes, the point still remains. We help them in their agenda.
Okay. There was a quote in the Times just really quickly from somebody who lives, you know, an Afghan person. Americans considered this punishing the Taliban, but it's punishing Afghans. And that's the reality here. The Taliban's doing fine. they'll be okay. They're the ruling class. The fact that there is not money available is hurting regular people. So we either... It's just a cynical thing. These lawmakers don't want to be seen as giving money to the Taliban and not giving it to 9/11 victims. When, newsflash, the government could just give money to the 9/11 victims.
All right, we're going to take a break and have a message from our sponsor. When we come back, we'll be talking to writer and filmmaker Rupert Russell, author of Price Wars, How the Commodities Markets Made Our Chaotic World. Folks, we've been reading ZipRecruiter ads for years now, and I guess it must have been, I don't know, when did Brendan come on? 5 years ago? 4 years ago? 5 years ago. 4 years ago. Holy cow. So we must have been reading ZipRecruiter ads for at least 5 years, because they had sponsored the program, and when it came time to hire, I figured I'd use their service or at least check it out. I had checked it out just in terms of like the free service, and so I dug deeper into it, and we got a tremendous amount of response on there, and ZipRecruiter went out and grabbed Brendan. And that's how we had old Brendan, still with the show, but from afar. And sort of that's how we got Bradley, was through Brendan. Like, he almost birthed Bradley in a way. I mean, I don't want to go through the details, but look, it's a great idea to keep learning new skills. If you're always learning, it keeps you sharp. Well, ZipRecruiter's AI is always learning. So if you're hiring, their AI gets better and faster at finding the right candidates for all of your roles. It gets a sense of what you're looking for, what skill set, et cetera, et cetera. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses powerful technology to find and match the right candidates, match them up with your job, and then it proactively presents these candidates to you. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job, which encourages them to apply faster. It's no wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. based on G2 ratings. Folks, again, couldn't have been more pleased with my experience with ZipRecruiter. Made it also not only easy to find great candidates, but organize it through their interface. Now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. All right, I want to welcome to the program writer and filmmaker Rupert Russell, author of Price Wars, How the Commodities Markets Made Our Chaotic World. Rupert, welcome to the show. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Great to have you. Great to be here.
It's great to have you, and I'm glad that you're here. So let's just start. I know that your first film, Freedom for the Wolf, was sort of a look at sort of nascent, I guess, strains of what was happening in the world that have sort of like since been more pronounced, and a lot of this was, you know, in the wake of the Arab Spring, and sort of what you guys sort of point out was sort of like some pockets of sort of rising authoritarianism and whatnot. I want to sort of swing that back around, but let's start with the idea of why you used price, the concept of prices, as a nexus to tell this story. And then we'll move from there.
That's a great question. So where do I begin? Begin with prices. Sure. So I had moved back to the UK the day after Brexit. I lived in America for 10 years. And I came back from the States, and I had no idea what was going on at all. It was this, the whole political establishment had been turned upside down. The prime minister like resigned as soon as my plane got in. And I just wanted to know what was happening. What was going on? Why had the country that I had grown up in turned itself inside out? And so I began, you know, looking into what was going on. And the biggest thing at the time was the global refugee crisis. That was really what had made immigration and right-wing populism so salient at the time, and really kind of pushed this anti-immigrant feeling to the foreground. And of course, having done the film, as you just mentioned, Freedom for the Wolf, I'd done quite a lot of work on the Arab Spring. But I was in that film, we were looking at, as you say, what had happened afterwards, right? The rise of a liberal democracy and authoritarianism. But I had come across some research at the time that was looking at food prices. And there was this mathematician out in Boston who'd done some work on food prices, the Arab Spring, and then the entire cascade that had created, right? So it didn't stay in Tunisia, obviously. It went to Egypt, Jordan, Yemen, Syria, even Saudi Arabia, Kuwait. And then what happens, of course, by 2015 is you have all these revolutions, you have the global refugee crisis. And so that was kind of the beginning of it. It was kind of working back from Brexit to the Arab Spring and then kind of forward again.
All right, so let's go into the myth of prices as articulated by, you go through how they're the myths that are articulated by Hayek and Friedman, of essentially the libertarian neoliberal perspective on what prices are supposed to do.
Sure, that's right. So if you look at an economic textbook or you watch, you know, Milton Friedman's documentary Free to Choose on YouTube, as I did, and you'll hear this very kind of enlightening, kind of very commonsensical story about you've got buyers in a marketplace and you've got sellers in a marketplace, and they kind of come together and they negotiate what the price of, you know, bread should be, or a bushel of wheat or oil or whatever it may be. And that's the sort of the standard way in which we think about the economy. But what's sort of been happening over the last two decades, and really what the book is about, is the role of finance in this, right? So you don't just have that buyer and seller of, you know, a physical commodity. Let's just take wheat, right? I'm a farmer. I grow wheat. I take it to Chicago. And then there's a guy who I sell it to. Maybe they're a hotel chain. Maybe they own supermarkets, right? There's this third actor involved in it. And this is sort of finance. They've always been there, right? Since the mid-19th century, you've always had speculators in Chicago, and they were brought in to sort of solve a problem, really, which was that you wanted people to be there to make sure there was always a seller for the farmer. That's why it's called a futures price. It can be a bit jargony, but the idea is you sell your crop in the future, or you rather agree a price in the future. And the whole point of this is to give farmers stability. It's supposed to be in the farmer's interest. And of course, what happens at the beginning of, in the mid-19th century is, great idea, complete chaos breaks out immediately. Right, because rather than this being this nice kind of folksy, you know, loan, essentially, what ends up happening is people use these contracts as a way to kind of speculate on the price of pork bellies or wheat or whatever it may be, if your viewers have watched, you know, Trading Places, for example. And you have decades of sort of chaos in Chicago. Roosevelt comes in and he puts an end to this, right? So Roosevelt comes in, they pass a whole load of legislation, and they limit the amount of speculative activity on commodities. That gets undone in 2000 by.
Yeah, let's slow down, because I want to spend some time on this so that people really get it. So, I mean, just to be clear, what that constitutes when Roosevelt comes in and basically regulates, we call it regulating, you know, sort of the commodities market, but what we're doing is we're also putting a cap on price, right? Because we're not, it's sort of a second order. Or at the very least, it is eliminating or constraining one of the things that could affect price at that point, right? I mean, so I just want to be explicit about that, because there was a lot of value in futures for farming, because like you say, one year my crop could be bad, one year it's not, and it sort of smooths out, to the extent that you can smooth it out, and it smooths out those potential risks, and it also, you know, it mitigates some of the risk for everybody associated, because we have a vested interest in having farmers, and if one year farmers get wiped out, then we have a problem with food next year. So I just wanted to, like, you know, put a fine point on that, and then let's go into, and let's start actually. You cover this in your book, this sort of fight between Brooksley Bourne, who was at that time the chairperson of the Commodities Future Trading Commission. This is a, sort of a semi-independent government agency where the president appoints the chair. And Alan Greenspan, who at that time was the chair of the Fed, I think, at that time. Okay, so pick it up from there, because this is very important. This is happening in the late 90s when there's this Clinton is being told by his, Robin Rubenites, it's time to deregulate all this stuff.
Absolutely. So it was actually, in the kind of folklore, the lore of this story is that it's, Brooksley Bourne, chairperson of the CFTC. The CFTC, because futures contracts originate in the 19th century with wheat and commodities, sort of futures and options trading falls underneath that purview, underneath the kind of Roosevelt framework, right? So that's why she's the one in charge of this, or at least in charge of asking the question of whether or not new financial products, not commodities, should be regulated. And so these are the kind of lovely things we all know and love called like credit default swaps, right? Swaps on currencies, exchange rates. These are kind of bets on other financial instruments, not bets on things in the real world, but bets on sort of intangible things. And there had already been some detonations, right? So I think Procter & Gamble had bought some contracts that had gone wrong and cost them a huge amount, tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions. Orange County, I think, lost billions of dollars in trades they didn't really understand. And this was a very fast-growing part of finance and sort of Wall Street. And so Brooksley Bourne's like, okay, some things are exploding out there. Maybe we should kind of look at them. And there's this famous phone call that Larry Summers makes to her and says, I've got 13 bankers in my office. And they say, if you go ahead and even ask the question of whether or not these financial products should be regulated, then we're going to have the biggest financial crisis since World War II. Now, Brooksley Bourne goes ahead. She ignores Larry Summers. She releases her report. Surprise, surprise, there's no financial crisis. But this is just, if you like, the opening shot. Because then Alan Greenspan and Larry Summers then organize this committee hearing to kind of ambush her. And it's a fascinating window into this period of American history, because you really see the arguments that they were making. And essentially what Greenspan says is, he says, look, derivatives are amazing. They're essentially risk mitigation devices, right? Just like for farmers, they're there to kind of help people, manage risk. And it's the financial industry that's going to be taking on risk. And these things aren't really going to blow up, right? Something may happen in like the real world that might explode, and that might be reflected in the markets, but the markets themselves aren't going to be doing it. And of course, Greenspan wins this argument. Brooksley Bourne essentially is forced to resign. And Greenspan and Larry Summers and two others at the top of the Clinton administration author a report that becomes the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that passed in 2000, signed by Clinton. And this deregulates not only the commodity markets, food, fuel, gold, wheat, the things we know. It also says that these new financial products can never be regulated. And this kind of sets the stage for the financial crisis, but also a series of other crises, which I look at in my book.
I just want people to remember, because Larry Summers, sadly, is still with us. And I'm not talking about that he's still alive. I'm perfectly...
He's still relevant. He's critiquing the fact that the New York Times is platforming Stephanie Kelton. Yeah,
he's in right. Biden's ear right now about inflation. I mean, this guy has been cataclysmically wrong, and it's important to point that out. And we see it. We could see it most clearly in 2008. But there's a whole series of cascading things that happened in the wake of that. So let's get into the implications of that. And you track it through. One of the ways you track this is through food prices. Let's talk about food prices, and particularly, I hadn't remembered this for years. I don't know that I've talked about it for years, but certainly I remember in the aughts, the late aughts, talking about Goldman Sachs and their involvement in food prices without ever owning and at one point, I think they did buy warehouses just as a way of driving up food prices, but not so much food prices as much as they're derivatives of food prices. But go into that topic because it's fascinating. And then we start to see how this cascades, and we see it in our politics.
That's right. So, you know, we're familiar now with how, you know, credit default swaps for housing didn't really, in reality, work as insurance products, right? They ended up being speculative weapons. And the way in which the sort of the so-called quants in Wall Street were calculating these derivatives actually ended up funneling tons of money into the bubble and ended up becoming a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. A very similar thing was happening with another derivative product that Goldman Sachs championed, but other banks such as AIG and other institutions were also selling, which were called commodity index funds. And this was a huge piece of the 2000s. Now, you want to remember that, you know, we talk about speculation, but it's actually, without derivatives, speculation is quite hard, right? So say you're somebody and you're like, okay, I think the price of oil's going to go up. What are you going to do? You're going to go get a tanker, fill it with oil, pay for it to be in the Boston Harbor. I mean, it's a nightmare, right? You're a hedge fund guy, or you're at a bank, you want to go to dinner at 5:30, you don't want to be dealing with like tankers and things like that. It's much easier just to buy these derivative products, but they didn't exist until Goldman Sachs and others sort of invented them. And the way in which they worked was they essentially created an asset class of commodities. So as I was saying earlier, you know, your traditional model, your neoliberal free market model is you've got a buyer and a seller, and there's maybe a middleman to kind of facilitate the transaction. What ends up happening with these index funds is that financial piece of the kind of awkward love triangle becomes enormous, right? So suddenly this thing that was supposed to be just greasing the wheel ends up becoming huge. So just for reference, in 2008, when food prices end up sort of skyrocketing like this, there was one hedge fund manager who kind of blew the whistle to Congress called Michael Masters, and his fund essentially calculated using data from the CFTC that these derivative products were essentially buying more commodity futures than China was buying for its economy, right? Just so you get a scale of this, when you hear people talking about, oh, there's all this demand from China having an industrial revolution, it was tiny, right, compared to what American pension funds, banks, university endowments were spending through these derivatives. And of course, once you create all of this demand, it ends up pushing up prices. And the other piece of this...
All right, so wait, will you walk us through this just a little bit here? Okay, so they come in and they start to corner the market on futures for, let's just say, grain, for wheat, let's say. How does that trickle down to prices today, for instance? Or is it simply the middlemen who are delivering the wheat go, oh, wait a second, this bushel of wheat I have today cost $10, but in the future, it's going to cost a lot more because I'm seeing what the future prices are because people have already sort of bought up all the future production, and they're going to have almost like a monopoly on this product, and they've paid this much to control it. So when they sell it, they're going to expect a higher price. And so I better start to raise my price now, right? Because I can, because it's still less than what it's going to be in the future.
Yeah, exactly. So when prices are going up in any market, it kind of creates an incentive to hold on to whatever you have, right? If you think if the price today is $10, but tomorrow it's $12, you're going to wait till tomorrow. Now imagine you've got a guaranteed price of $20 in the future. It's $10 today, but I can actually just go and get a contract and I can hold on to this in a warehouse. Now, the thing about derivatives is they're, massively complex. And when I interviewed Joseph Stiglitz, he made the point to me. He's like, that's the point. The point of them is you don't understand them. And the sort of the story that I've told you about, you know, you can speculate on, you know, the price of food or oil, or really what they were selling was commodities as an asset class by buying this. The actual way in which these contracts operated meant that even the people who were buying low and you would think sell high lost money. Right? The alchemy was so complicated that not only were people losing money, but the people who were making the real money were the people who were buying all the storage facilities. And so what does Goldman Sachs do? They start owning oil tankers. They start owning these huge warehouses for all kinds of commodities, aluminium in particular. Not only that, there's a third component where actually, I have to say, we don't know this 100%, but it's not illegal, as one person said to me, it's not illegal to do, so why wouldn't you do it? These funds were also being front-run, right? So you have people going in into these funds and then front-running the contracts before they roll. This all may sound like complete gibberish, but the point is that this entire construction was not even about betting on commodities. It was almost like a scam within a scam within a scam. And then the sort of weird byproduct of this is that global food prices double and 100 million people go hungry in 2008.
So this is basically just, you know, somebody making a side bet off the side bet of some people playing, you know, blackjack somewhere, essentially, or maybe three or four side bets, and to the point where the original game of blackjack is irrelevant as to what's happening here. Okay, so the implication is the price of food goes up, then what happens, and where are we in our history, and specifically as we start to see social upheaval?
Exactly right. So in 2008, you have a global food price spike. It's all commodities, right? Because these derivative products were essentially turning 25 commodities odd into one asset class. So historically, the price, you know, the price of cotton or the price of wheat or coal or oil, you know, they were independent from each other. They were different markets, different, you know, they're produced in different parts of the world. One might have a war going on, one might have a drought, who knows, right? But once they started being treated as an asset class, suddenly all the prices start working, start being correlated to one another. So what ends up happening is the housing bubble bursts around 2007. So that was one asset that a lot of people in finance had had money in. Now, what do you do when one asset is collapsing, one asset class? You move it into another asset class, right? So the bubble migrated from housing into commodities. And commodities compared to housing is a tiny, tiny, tiny market. So you don't need very much of that money to have a huge impact on prices. And it's really striking when you see these graphs of just, you know, housing collapsing. And as the housing prices collapse, the commodity prices boom. And as they boom, you start to see riots break out in 48 countries in 2008. You have two governments that are, that are deposed, and the UN declares it a global food crisis. But of course, the big story that I focus on in my book is this whole process happens again in 2010. The financial alchemy is slightly different, but it's essentially a very similar story, and the outcome is the same. But this time we have the Arab Spring. This time you have it on a much, much, much bigger scale. You have Tunisia deposed, Egypt, the civil war. This is the origin of the civil war in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya. There's protests in Georgia. The regime is shocked in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia. And then from that point, that is when you get the cascading crises, right? It's like opening Pandora's box. It's not just that people went hungry and that you had riots and revolutions and some instability. It's that you're essentially plunging an entire region into a kind of Hobbesian nightmare, and one that's still happening today.
And so this is what you call the butterfly effect, I guess, is that you have these ripples one place. And as this light breeze happens way over here, by the time it migrates over here, it is having much, much greater impact. So when we talk about the what happens, particularly in Syria, what follows? Take us through these sort of cascading crises that end up leading to the political sort of, I guess, instability or changes that we see throughout the rest of the world.
Sure. So in a lot of post-colonial countries, such as in the Middle East, when the European colonies were sort of kicked out, the new generation of revolutionary leaders came in with a social contract. It's also called the authoritarian bargain in the Middle East, which is essentially, you know, we guarantee you bread, some kind of security, sustenance for your family, and you let us, you know, rule the country, right? So this is a sort of better words have baked into the social contract. Now, what happened in 2010 is that social contract gets broken. Global food prices essentially double in a very short period of time. And this had come off the back of not just the 2008 food price spike, but also the global financial crisis, right? So it's imagined as taking a beating. This is like the third beating, and the third beating, these regimes just do not have the financial capital to keep up the subsidies, right? Because normally they're more or less subsidizing food prices for ordinary people, but they simply cannot sustain it. And so you end up seeing a lot of the first protests in Egypt, in Tunisia, Jordan, Yemen, with essentially claims for bread and freedom, bread and water. The slogans vary, but bread is a very kind of consistent theme. And in each place, the regime tries to say, okay, we're going to spend $100 million on bread subsidies, and we might give you some more jobs and so forth. And the regimes that are the only regimes that are really able to kind of upgrade the social contract or rather keep it in place are the oil juggernauts. So Saudi Arabia ends up, you know, giving tons of money to people. So does Kuwait. I mean, in the sense of thousands of dollars to individual people to kind of get them off the streets and back at home. Like, don't worry, guys, you know, we're going to pay for you. And the regimes that are unable to do that in the Middle East are the ones with very little oil revenue. So that's why it's Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Syria. It's why it's those countries that end up sinking into civil war, because they're not able to upkeep the social contracts. Now, there's two exceptions to this. One is Libya. Lots of oil money, but this is a foreign intervention. NATO comes in and essentially kind of ends whatever Gaddafi's fight back may have been. A very similar story happens in Syria with Iran and Russia essentially propping up Assad in 2011. The same support was not offered in Yemen, Egypt, and Tunisia, and that's why those regimes crumble. Now, what ends up happening in Syria is you, of course, have essentially a vacuum, right? And in neighboring Iraq, thanks to the 2004-3 so-called liberation, there had been this kind of al-Qaeda in Iraq offshoot that had been kind of bubbling away for quite a while. The Americans had essentially defeated it by around 2011. It was sort of like a rump hanging out in northern Iraq. But because there was a vacuum in northern Syria, they ended up jumping over the border, and that was ISIS, right? So ISIS had kind of been like in waiting for a kind of opening. And unfortunately, Syria was absolutely that vacuum. And of course, it happened in Libya as well. ISIS pops up in Libya as well. And then it ends up, two things that are happening. One is you end up with a global terror network. And the second thing is a crucial part of this entire story for my book is looking at how all of this turmoil also pushes up oil prices, right? So all this turmoil is pushing up oil prices. And then who does that benefit? People have oil fields, which in this case is also ISIS, right? ISIS captures a whole bunch of Syrian oil fields right at a time when oil prices are going up. And it ends up producing this massive revenue stream to kind of keep these civil wars, to kind of keep these civil wars going. One of the first thing that happens, of course, all wars end up producing refugees. In the first couple of years, they end up in neighboring countries, such as Tunisia for Libya, that is, or Lebanon for Syria. But by 2015, they end up going abroad for lots of reasons. And that ends up hitting Europe. And that's where you get the beginning of the global refugee crisis and also the beginning of right-wing populism in Europe. That's when the super authoritarian government gets elected in Poland. It's when Italy goes for a populist right-wing coalition government. And then Austria and France, they come in narrow seconds. So that's this kind of cascade that you can see.
And we should add, there was also, I think, about 2 million Iraqi refugees that had already sort of like, you know, saturated, I guess you could say, sort of and limited the places where other refugees from the sort of the cascading civil wars would go. So this is all emanates from essentially this artificial inflation of the prices of food. You also give other examples of how this happens. And at one point, you write about the relationship, or I should say, maybe the analogies between oil and drugs in terms of pricing. Why pricing can't necessarily, trying to drive up the price of something as a way of inhibiting its use isn't always necessarily the way to diminish its production, I guess, is the way to articulate it, right? Will you walk us through that dynamic as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is just sort of basic economics, right? If you limit supply, the price will go up. Now, in commodities, it doesn't actually need to diminish. You just need a perception of future problems, right? So it could be that, like right now, there's, 100, maybe 200,000 Russian troops on the border of Ukraine. Russia's a massive petrostate supplying around 10% of the world's oil supply. So what's happening with the price fall? It's shooting up. Why? Because they're pricing in the risk of a future war, right? So this is how futures markets this is how all markets are happening. And also, incidentally, who does this benefit? Russia, right? Saudi Arabia. So this has been, the commodity markets currently are really helping the Kremlin by sending them tons of extra cash you wouldn't actually otherwise have if it wasn't for speculators pricing in the so-called risk of a war that may or may not happen. Who knows? When it comes to drugs, you see a similar effect happening. So this was a piece I wrote for Time recently. It's not, and I was sort of thinking about the war on drugs and thinking about, we also have been seeing in the news recently, climate activists scoring victories against oil companies. And I suppose my point was, we need to be careful what we wish for, right? Say we shut down all the supply of oil from Kuwait, or all of it from Iraq, or all of it from Saudi Arabia, right? Let's just live in that universe. What would happen to the price of oil? Shoot up, right? Just like with drugs, if the police or the federales or whoever, clamp down on one part of a cartel and they constrict supply, what happens? The price goes up. And as the price goes up, you're essentially offering a massive reward for anybody else to produce drugs and bring them to that area, right? And you see the same effect will happen in the oil markets. And this is what we've seen historically. So when you had historically high oil prices in the 1970s, that is when we discovered North Sea oil, right? It's really hard to get oil from underneath the North Sea. It's an easy thing to do. But if the oil price is, $130, $150, suddenly that becomes an attractive proposition for BP or other oil companies to go and do. The same thing happened during this period, 2011 to 2014. So the turmoil of the Arab Spring triggers these civil wars. This increases the price of oil. And what do we get? A global fracking boom, right? Fracking was expensive. It's difficult to do. It's a very tricky technology. But when oil is over $100 a barrel, suddenly there's a massive incentive for people to go and do it. And so you have these kinds of, they call them seesaw effects, where it's like, you constrict supply, perhaps it's a war, perhaps it's something else, perhaps it's it could be financialization, whatever it may be. And whenever you see these uptick in prices, you also see upticks in supply. And so the point I was trying to make in that is, it's a bit like with the war on drugs. Like, it's saying no, just say no to drugs, or if you're sort of Nancy Reagan, or on the other hand, if you just want to stamp down on drugs, neither of these things are really going to help alter the market. What you need to do is essentially produce a new market for renewables and simply replace oil completely.
So let me ask you about that just a little bit, because there are some areas where I'm convinced that sort of the analogy breaks down a little bit, insofar as if drug prices went up and I had the ability, and there was a competing product out there that would replace drugs, right? I mean, that's the, like, I think the narrative of the way, like, fracking, once oil gets above a certain cost, it makes sense to expend the amount of money that you need for fracking to get it out, because that you're going to get this amount of per barrel. And that's why we saw, like, the fracking, places, what is it, in Dakota, I guess, the economy just sort of deflated as soon as the price of oil dropped, because then it was no longer economically viable to pull it out of the ground there. Would the promise of future government regulation, or I've interviewed people who've suggested some type of physical sabotage of oil extraction, mechanisms, begin to undercut the desire for investors to bet on future revenues? With drugs, there's a lot of different ways you can produce it. The bar to entry is not necessarily that high to produce drugs. the barred entry is maybe in ship, large scale shipments and smuggling, but it's still not as high as building an oil rig, or, you know, developing these extraction methods. Can you implicate the future production of oil by inhibiting investment in the capitalization of that production of oil?
Well, two things. I'll address the first point about people blowing stuff up, right? Yeah, maybe we should go and blow up some oil pipelines. In fact, this is not science fiction. Kissinger wanted to do this in 1973 when the Arab-Israeli war broke out and the Saudis essentially embargoed the United States. And sort of Kissinger was sort of sitting in his office going, right, let's just bomb the oil wells. Then somebody had to point out to him that actually this is just going to make that problem worse, right? Because oil becomes more scarce. And not only that, the Saudi oil minister in the New York Times said, actually, we're going to bomb our own oil wells. That's actually going to advantage us so much because we're going to benefit from the higher prices. So this whole idea of bombing infrastructure is an old one, and Kissinger had to give up on it pretty much straight away. On the question of financing, I mean, yeah, it would be great if no banks ever lent to fossil fuel companies and new investment and so forth. I'm kind of skeptical of this. You've got, for example, the Belt Road project in China, which is essentially investment in commodity infrastructure, including gas and oil extraction. So, you know, we're not the only game in town. There's enormous pools of capital globally sitting around in, you know, pension funds, state treasuries. And the amounts of money involved here to extract oil are actually not that large. If we had a monopoly on financial capital, I'd say, yeah, go for it. But the reality is we just don't. Like, capital isn't scarce.
And so the idea is that in this instance, the thing you need to do is just bring in a different product.
Yeah, exactly. I think the lesson from the war on drugs is supply follows demand, right? Like, if people want something, if they're addicted to it, we even use the same metaphor, right? Addicted to oil. If people are addicted to something, they're going to keep buying it, and there'll always be a supplier to kind of step into the market. There may be little hiatuses, of course, that there'll be a few years or a moment when the market's kind of doing its magic to kind of get the commodity where it needs to be. But on the whole, I think the answer to this is simply to sort of cut off demand, which is to say, whether it's electric cars or updating the power grid or whatever it may be, you know, solar, wind power, that's kind of what we need to do. We need to move in that direction. I don't think attacking oil and making oil the enemy is going to be any more successful than making like heroin the enemy. Heroin is bad. I wish people didn't take heroin. It destroys lives and families. But, you know, telling people to say no to heroin, we've tried it 50 years. It hasn't really had any perceivable impact except to make people's lives worse.
So the idea in this scenario is the Build Back Better bill, which won't happen. I mean, but does the increasing the cost, I don't want to belabor this, but had Kissinger, what was the folly of Kissinger's idea of bombing Saudi Arabia at that time, was that also was part of the folly a function of just how space age solar power or wind power was at that time? In other words, you know, it's one thing to say in 1973 when we're still, I think U.S. was still pretty close to the number one exporter of oil in the world, soon to be not happening, but that was the case, I think, around that time. Had there been a somewhat viable solar, wind, other sustainable sources of energy, is it a different equation to...
That as well. I mean, they went for that, right? So talking about energy independence, I'm not sure if Nixon said it, but Carter definitely did, right? So Carter comes in during the second oil crisis happens, and he tells everyone, you know, turn down your heating, wear a jumper, right? Lower demand. And of course, there's lots of conservatives now who still have never forgiven Carter for saying that, right? There's this whole like weird culture online for like, I became a Reaganite the moment, you know, Carter told me to kind of put on a sweater. That was like such an affront to people's kind of sense of being in America. So the green, and of course I think Carter put solar panels on the roof of the White House. Of course, Reagan then took them off. So in some ways, this isn't new, but the economic dilemma fundamentally hasn't changed. You know, Europe still has 40% of their natural gas from Russia. This has been true for years and years and years and years. And they haven't been able to wean themselves off it. And this gives Putin a very strong hand, right? Because he knows they've got nowhere else to go, right? Are Germans suddenly going to have no heat for their homes, or Poles, or other people, especially in the Eastern Bloc? So that's why it's called the gas weapon. Against Kissinger, it was called the oil weapon. And it's very, very, very real. And politicians do not have many tools at their disposal in the short term. All we can really do is sort of hope we get some kind of Green New Deal or a Build Back Better, or maybe get central bank financing to build a kind of alternative energy source. But the EU, just like the US, has been unable or unwilling to do it.
All right. So lastly, so what can we take this understanding of price as a, I guess it's, is price just ultimately a good way to organize, you know, different happenings that are going on? Or can we reverse engineer it and implicate those developments that are really upstream from price? Can we go backwards? You know, can we reverse engineer and implicate those things that are upstream from price by constricting price in some way?
Well, we already do, right? So I think one of the big mythologies right now is that we live with a free market. I interviewed Joseph Stiglitz, who said, and he said this many times to many people, you know, the invisible hand is invisible because it doesn't exist, right? And that's always my kind of starting point. The Federal Reserve has been intervening in the US economy and the global economy since the late 1970s to prop up the price of financial assets, in particular the stock market, but other markets as well, including the market for US Treasuries most recently. So we already have a very interventionist state policy, both in Europe and in the United States. Unfortunately, we don't intervene for other prices, right? So financial assets are great for wealthy people, they're great for rich people, but we don't see any intervention or really any kind of, we don't even see it as a problem that global food prices have doubled, or the oil price goes up to such a, or the oil prices may even triple, in fact. And so what we need to do is we need to reorientate the institutions that already regulate and already set prices for the assets for wealthy people, and instead refocus those same tools for those which basically affect ordinary people, and especially those in the developing world who are harmed far more.
What are the arguments against doing that, other than sort of people being afraid of living, you know, I don't know, of this is an authoritarian state if we start to regulate the prices of food in the way that we regulate, you know, or inflate, you know, and that's just another form of regulation, the price of financial assets?
Well, food is already heavily regulated in the United States, the price that is. So, of course, you have massive subsidies to farmers, and then you then have food stamps, right? So we just don't have a free market when it comes to food in the United States. The piece of it, there's really sort of, I don't think, any defense that I've heard that makes any sense for this sort of the role of finance in commodities, right? Nobody's been able to say that the Roosevelt era regulations from the 30s until 2000, there was really anything wrong with these, right? The only thing that was wrong with them is that the banks were not able to turn them into securities and sell them to people and then create a scam within a scam within a scam. That's really all this is, right? You know, going back to the era of the 1990s or even the 1980s in terms of regulation is not going to some like past communist state the United States never had. It's going back to the Reagan era. What's wrong with that? Right? What's to complain about that? The problem is that so much of the profits on Wall Street come from securitization. They come from this financial alchemy, which is just taking these products in the real world that we all need as just these kind of like side bets for these other plays that they're making.
And so lastly, is there any move in Congress? Have you seen any indication, at least in the context of the U.S., that there's going to be Is there any movement to, and I guess the last chance we had that was Dodd, I don't know what ultimately became Dodd-Frank. There was a lot of people who were arguing for just a sort of essentially a 21st century Glass-Steagall. Has that push just completely vanished? Or is there, do you see any nascent?
No, it's still going on. It sort of bounces back. There's actually provisions in Dodd-Frank for this, for commodities specifically, but it kind of tends to bounce between the regulatory agencies, the court and Congress. You know, they're talking about limiting speculation again now. I think there's things happening, but does it exist? No, because the financial forces fighting against this are just so intense. It's just, can you overcome financial interests in regulation in the United States? And so far, the answer has been no.
Rupert Russell, author of Price Wars, How the Commodities Markets Made Our Chaotic World. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's great to chat.
Bye-bye. Oh, there you go.
Yep.
Thanks again, Wall Street. Peter Thiel on the how many investment bankers is Peter Thiel supporting in this?
It's the new populism.
Yep.
Definitely two.
At least two.
Folks, it is your support that allows us to do interviews like the one we just did. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, and when you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you also get the fun half of the program, which sometimes is actually fun. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's a mix. But it's always informative in some fashion or another. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget majoritylive.com.
Yes.
If you want to see the show in Brooklyn, which is happening in about 5 weeks, 6 weeks,
it's the 26th of March, yes.
Thank you. 2 p.m. It's a Saturday, so you can come from out of state, come into New York, come in Friday night.
The Big Apple, you ever heard of it?
The Onion, as they used to call it, too. The Big what? Onion. Did you know that?
No.
You peel the layers off it, and it stinks at the center or something like that?
No.
I think that was, at one time, it was the other.
I thought that's what people just said about you.
Hmm.
Why is it called the Big Apple?
That's a good question. I think they probably decided, like,
more appealing than onion.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm going to look it up.
But, folks, if you want tickets to the Brooklyn show, you better act very, very quick. We still have some tickets for the Boston show. That's happening in May. So you have a little bit more time to make up your mind, although buy your ticket now, because those in Brooklyn, I don't know if it's reserved seating. I think it's first come.
No, it's general admission.
General admission in Brooklyn. But in Boston, it's reserved seating.
Yeah.
So if you want a good seat, now there's no bad seats at the Wilbur Theater. It is like a very, like even when you get up onto the higher floors, it's.
I'm excited. I've never been there. It's
a beautiful theater.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful theater. We've got some special guests at the Boston show that. If you're even, let me put it this way with the Boston show. If you're even contemplating it and this special guest shows up, and I think that person will, you're going to be bummed. You didn't see it.
Whoa.
I mean, the Brooklyn show is going to be a ton of fun. And I don't know, I don't even know who are going to, you know, we've got, well, we'll announce like maybe, yeah, maybe later in this week we'll announce who at least the prelim lineup.
The Big Apple, it's called the Big Apple because a sports journalist, when writing about horse races and race courses in New York, he referred to the prizes to be won here as the Big Apple, symbolizing the biggest and best that one can achieve. That's pretty stupid.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah. Horse racing?
A lot of apples from upstate New York, too.
I meant to text you. I had my first Snapdragon yesterday.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a Honeycrisp.
Well, here's the dirty little secret. You don't need as much pesticides sprayed on the Snapdragon.
I got it at the farmer's market. Very good.
Very good.
Anyways,
majoritylive.com to get tickets for that. Also, our AM Quickie. Check it out. One of our writers, Corey and Jack, write it. They switch off every day. Jack is, I think, I don't know if he's there quite yet or if he's en route. He's there in Ukraine.
Oh, wow.
And I'm hoping he will provide us some actual dispatches for the show. But certainly, he's on the ground there doing some reporting. So you want to come and check out the AM Quickie, amquickie.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Great coffee company. Matt. Someone just, I can't believe you got Steven Crowder for the Boston show. No, it is not Steven Crowder.
Who told you?
Although, I wonder how much money I'd have to pay him to show up at one of these shows. I mean, it would, like, the show would end up costing.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I was going to say, the show would end up costing, like, $125,000.
Yeah.
But how awesome would it be to, like, write him a check that bounced?
Very Tinder swindler of you.
I wonder if, like, I got to watch that documentary, yeah. But I wonder if, like, it would, if I could get away with giving him a check that would bounce. Because I certainly could not get away with giving him a check that would clear for that kind of money. But I could definitely give him a check that would bounce. I wonder if he would take a personal check.
We could
or
just.
If they would deposit it, be like, we need to see the money in the account before we get there.
We could, like, get him to show up under false pretenses, being like, oh, you know, new Hollywood role for you. It's grown-up Arthur characters.
That might do it.
It would need to be like a Sacha Baron Cohen-style trap.
Right, right, right.
Or what if I agreed to pay him in, like, some type of new Majority Report minted crypto?
Bitcoin.
I don't think it can have anything to do with the Majority Report.
Okay, well then let's make up a new crypto. Oh, that actually... All right. Well, we'll talk about the potential scam later.
Daddy's boy coin.
Well, no, I was just thinking, like, we could pretend, like, I saw that ad, that Larry David ad. I had no idea what it was for at the end. And it was like for SFX or something like this. And I'm
too
like,
many people talking.
I don't know. I don't know what it was. And there's so many different cryptos that have been launched. I feel like it wouldn't be that hard to create a fake crypto. Or even a real crypto, which is sort of fake.
They have created fake cryptos, right? Like, there's been the guy that created a fake crypto in L.A. made scam people out of something like $7 million.
Well, I don't want to scam people out of it, but I would pay Crowder all in crypto to show. Oh. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, go check out last week's episode where we had Mike Preisner on. We talked about Ukraine, Afghanistan, and the Red Hill fuel containment facility in Hawaii that its leakages in the main aquifer in Oahu have been covered up even when it started poisoning the sailors for the Navy. That's in Pearl, like right next to Pearl Harbor. So that's how much United States military cares. This weekend, we had a premium episode with Paradoomer Aaron Thorpe, formerly known as Posadas Trap God of the Trillbilly Workers' Party podcast, on to talk about a piece that he did on nostalgia and futurelessness and how we can escape the idea that all the futures are like Elon Musk torturing animals in a segregated facility. That's the new future we have to look forward to and how we can escape that. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
I'm jealous you got him on. We were talking about how he's got great taste. I want to. Yeah.
Both those guests are good. We should have Preisner on at one point. Check out the Empire Files for more on that. On what's going on in Hawaii. All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the phone number. We will see you in the so-called fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back. Back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males, psych,
fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Black. Come on. Black. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy, 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 pussy.